How many of you have read Isaiah 53 in the context of the Lord's Supper, either during the observance or in preparation for it? Anybody? Okay, so about half the class. Anybody else read it at all? Okay, a few nods, so that's good. All right, we're starting on common ground. So you have a little bit of experience with this text, maybe more than with some of the other prophetic passages we've looked at. So I'd like to just collect your ideas about what you want to talk about in this chapter. What in this chapter kind of has always puzzled you, or do you kind of wonder, you know, what's this detail mean, or where is this fulfilled in the New Testament? Or I know that it's fulfilled in the New Testament, but I don't understand what it, you know, how it's a fulfillment of what happens here. So I'll start. This is the one that I have been thinking about, which is, why is the same speaker whose preaching is not believed in verse 1, who has believed our message, why is that same speaker rejecting the servant in verses 3 through 4? Right? We ourselves esteemed him stricken. We hid our faith, or we did not esteem him. It's the same person. So why is that? So I'm going to summarize this. I guess I can just pose it as a question. And why that transition from, from sort of being a preacher to one who is not believing. All right, what else? So I'm taking from this that everyone has thoroughly understood everything in the chapter every time we've read it, which is good because that's better than I've been.
In verse 10, when it says, "He shall see his offspring," towards the middle of the verse,
yep.
Who is the he there? And if it is referring to the suffering servant, and is that indicating that the servant would, in a sense, be a father? Going back to Isaiah 9.
Good. Anything else?
Go ahead. The real hard question is, why do we have to suffer?
Okay.
Well, is there any other way?
All right.
11. Now, is the ESV, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see. Satisfy that part there.
What is he seeing?
What is he seeing? It says in the Dead Sea Scrolls of the Masoretic text that scroll says he shall see the light.
Yeah. Anything else?
What is the portion being divided in 12? I would divide him a portion to many. He shall divide the spoil with the strong.
Okay.
I guess in 3:2 where he says he's despised and rejected by men, and then that he's acquainted with grief and sorrow as well. He bore our feelings, I guess, so that he can understand them.
Right. So
that's interesting point to me.
Are you asking, are those two lines parallel to one another? Like, are they describing the same thing or two different things? Is that what you're asking?
Or maybe just an observance of how he was sent here, right? Experienced all these emotions.
Uh-huh.
And then he was able to relate when this happened.
Okay, right. So, and that is that's an important point that we'll talk about, the personal nature of this, of the suffering. Good. Anything else?
Why did they divide the chapter where they did?
Yeah, I should have asked you to also look at 52, 13 to 15. Yeah, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm just going to ignore the chapter. But that's a good question. All right, anything else? This is your chance to, like, I've always wanted to know this. This is your chance. I might not answer it, but you can at least share it. Yes?
So I think this is probably, I think I have started to understand this more. But I think as an American kid growing up in a strong Christian, and you can use that as broadly as you want, culture, I think I have struggled to understand what someone who was stricken and afflicted then experienced versus what they experience now. Because now, at least my growing up culture was like, you help the people who are afflicted and sick, as opposed to that's a sign that they've done something wrong, those sorts of things. So I think the gravity of that was probably lost on me in my younger years. And even now, not being, you know, a Jew in ancient times, so that's not really a question now necessarily, but it was definitely something that I just didn't, and probably truly still don't understand what that, the implications of suffering, affliction, those sorts of things meant.
Right.
For the treatment of a person then versus...
That's a really good question. And I honestly, it's not one that I was really going to spend a lot of time on. But I would point you back to... you said you already have some answers, so you may have a better one than this. I would point you back to 52:11-12, where God says, get away, don't touch anything that's unclean. If you saw suffering as a sign that God was punishing someone and he disfavored them, you would say, well, I need to stay as far away from that as I can so that I myself don't become contaminated. And in fact, we even see things like that in the New Testament, right, in Jude, where we're supposed to help people, but we're supposed to make sure that we ourselves are not defiled by the things that that they're engaged in. But you're right, there is a cultural level to it, kind of, as a society, turning away from it. And I think, if anything, it's a sign of how far our culture has drifted from standards of godliness, that we feel compelled, culturally, socially, to help people who sort of refuse to help themselves and refuse to do the things that would actually improve their own situation. You know what I mean? So even in that compassion, which feels like a good thing, I think there's a little bit of rebellion, which we've actually already seen in Isaiah, right? Of I forget which king it is now. Refusing to ask for a sign is kind of false humility, you know, maybe something similar there. But that's a really good question. Okay, so that's a good place to start. Here's our simplified outline of Isaiah, complete with alliteration. We are in the third section now, the messianic messages, and you'll notice that mathematically, to Eric's comment, the chapter divisions seem a little bit arbitrary, but mathematically at least, chapter 53 is right in the middle of this third section. It is the center chapter. I don't think that means anything, except that it's a nice symmetry. But I do think that chapter 53, however you want to divide it up, is important in the flow of this, and I think it might help us to understand what's going on in this chapter to see how it fits into its into the context. So Isaiah 53 is the last of four servant songs in the book, and it's the longest one. The first three are very short. But it's 42, 1 through 4, 49, 1 through 6, and 50, 4 through 9. We've looked at each of these already. We looked at it in the last class. But it's important to see how they flow into one another, and then how 52:13 to 53:12 grows naturally out of them. So in 42, the first song, God sets forth the servant as his agent of justice, as both a king and a prophet. And we observed that last time. There is kingship language embedded in the description of the servant there in 42, 1 through 4. But God speaks there and says, here is my servant. In 49, the servant speaks, and he recounts God's call to him from before he was born to restore Israel and ultimately to restore the whole world. In chapter 50, the servant speaks again. He describes his mistreatment, but also his faith in God, that God will justify him and restore him. And there's not a lot of detail in those about what that suffering would be, what that justification, that triumph would involve, what the king, as a king, how he's going to rule. Those details are not really present in the first three servant songs, but they are all present in the fourth one, in 52, 1 through 3. So he describes the exaltation and the rule that's promised in 42. He explains how the servant, this chapter explains how the servant fulfills his mission of restoring Israel and the whole world. He goes into the detail about what that's going to involve. He did detail, and this is the thing that we all kind of know about 53, it details the mistreatment that is mentioned in chapter 50, verses 4 through 9, and it also then explains God's vindication of his suffering. But what 53 does that is that really contributes to the image of the servant, the suffering servant in Isaiah, is that it adds that the result of this work will be redemption and forgiveness. Not just restoration, but redemption and forgiveness of sins. And that's a totally new concept, not only in Isaiah, but even in the Old Testament, at the level that Isaiah 53 describes.
What's really interesting, too, is that the Ethiopian nobleman was very confused about that.
Yes.
Because obviously he was a very devout Jew, and he was a proselyte, so he had to get it the hard way. He wasn't born that way.
Right.
And so even he's going, is he talking about himself or somebody else? How does this king, prophet,
yes,
servant, sufferer, how does that all work together?
And so the one important takeaway of that is that this is not an easy thing to put together if you only had the Old Testament up through the book of Isaiah, right? It's not the kind of thing you'd read and you'd go, oh, obviously it's going to be united to Jesus and he's going to die on the cross and the Romans are ruling the world. You know what I mean? Maybe if you had Daniel, you'd start to put some of those pieces together, but certainly not all of them. And so we'll talk a little bit about the Ethiopian eunuch and sort of what I think Philip was going to had to explain to him in order to draw the connection between the suffering of Isaiah 53 and the next thing we hear from the Ethiopian eunuch, which is, see, here's water, what hinders me from being baptized. I think that the way he gets from that point A to point B there is something interesting to think about. But part of it has to do with, I think, as Greg is pointing out, with the context of this fourth servant song in the book of Isaiah. The other kind of contextual point that I want us to see is that chapter 53 is part of the discussion in chapters 52 through 56 of God's plan to redeem Israel. It doesn't exist in isolation. It's a part of a continuous flow of thought. It starts in 52 where God says, guess what? I'm going to redeem Israel and I'm going to protect them from their enemies. In chapter 53, God and Israel both speak and say the servant is the source of that redemption for Israel. In 54, God speaks again and says, because of the servant, I will show you mercy and love. That's a really cool connection between 53 and 54. It was the question about he shall see his seed. He'll see his offspring. Verse 10, he'll see his offspring, he will prolong his days. Look at 54, verse 1. Shout for joy, O barren one, you who have borne no child. Break forth into joyful shouting and cry aloud, you have not travailed. For the sons of the desolate one will be more numerous than the sons of the married woman, says the Lord. Enlarge the place of your tent. Stretch out the curtains of your dwelling. Spare not. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your pegs, for you will spread abroad to the right and the left, and your descendants will possess nations and will resettle the desolate city. I think 54 is picking up on that idea of the servant suffering and yet being, you know, saved and seeing his offspring, and expanding on that to begin this discussion of how God is going to show Israel mercy and love as a result of the work of the servant. And that connection with the seed language or descendant language, I think, is a key unifying point between those two chapters. In 55, we talked about this last time, the living waters, anyone who thirsts, anyone who wants this can receive mercy and love. All you have to do is come, which of course involves admitting that you don't have the power to save yourself and all of that. But anyone who is willing to make those admissions and to come for this living water can have it. Yes.
It's interesting, in prior to 53:10, where he talks about the offspring.
Yes.
And verse 11, where it talks about servant, that's the last time in Isaiah that servant is used in a singular way.
That's
and
right.
After that, it's servants,
yeah,
because of the offspring that he's creating through his suffering.
I think that's a very good point. I think that helps make sense of what happens afterwards. Is this is the work of the servant. The work of the servant is, in one sense, maybe only in one sense, completed. And now we see the results of that work as we move forward in the book. I think that's very good. And so in 56, then the end of this kind of section of the book, God says, if you will obey me, I will bless you immeasurably. And again, a connection is picking up there on 55:7, which says, let the wicked forsake his way, the unrighteous man his thoughts, let him return to the Lord. Verse 50, or chapter 56, verse 1, thus says the Lord, preserve justice and do righteousness, for my salvation is about to come, and my righteousness is to be revealed. How blessed is the man who does this, and the Son of Man who takes hold of it. Not the Son of Man, just a person, the descendant of Adam. And so, chapter 56 then is, if you obey me, I will bless you immeasurably. And so Isaiah 53 is the kind of the hinge point of this discussion. It is the reason why all of the blessings that are available beginning in chapter 54 are available, is because of the work of the servant. And it is the fulfillment of God's promise in 52 to restore and redeem Israel. So if you were going to try to answer one of the objectives, you might say something like, Isaiah 53 is the last of the four servant songs, and it fills in details hinted at by the others. And Isaiah 53 is the centerpiece of the discussion in chapters 52 to 56 of God's plan to redeem Israel. All right, so this is all just like introduction and background stuff. We've looked at the text a little bit, but we have one more introductory exercise. But any questions or comments about this high-level stuff so far? I'm trying to get through this stuff quickly so that we can get into the text and really discuss it and pick it apart. We noted these themes of Isaiah, and we saw how they are all sort of evident in Isaiah's call in chapter 6 in the throne room scene there. And we noted that all of these themes find their ultimate expression in Christ's person, life, and salvation. And so, in that kind of context, I think it would be useful to look for these themes in 52:13 to 53:12. So, we need to divide into six groups. How many people do we have? 3, 6, 9, 12, 15. Good, it's not divisible by 6. Excellent. It's okay, so you guys are married, so you can work together, theoretically. The three of you work together, Chester and you two. That's two in the back corner, can you guys do that? And then the three, two elders and an evangelist, that's the lovely group. And then, and then David and Lindsay, you guys are a group, and then the three of you, sorry you're in the line, but you guys are a group as well. All right, so I'll give the back group the hardest one. You guys take number 6, people's exile and return. Elder and evangelist group, exile and return. You do 1, greatest group, do 2. You guys do 3, 4 up here in Chester's group, and 5 in the last group. The people's inability to hear the word. Alright?
Assignment again is 1. Yeah.
I just want you to look for this your assignment
in
Isaiah 53. Okay.
Just 53?
Looking for
52:12 to 52:13
to 53.
Did you
hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. Do we need to read all through 53?
Isaiah's case.
Yeah. Okay. Let's believe what he has heard from us. To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grows like a young plant, and like a root of dry ground. Yet no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men. That's probably an easy one right there. Verse 3. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hid their faces, he was despised and we esteemed not. That's a sign of rejection. Only verse 3. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. If he has been stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. I think 4 as well. I think we might have gotten the easiest one.
So far, so good.
First five. But he was pierced for our transgressions, and he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him the chastisement that brought us peace, and his wounds were healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. There you go, verse 6 again. It's rejection of things away. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of the Lord. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, like a lamb that was led to the slaughter, and sheep that left the fourth shear is the silence, so he opened not his mouth. So right now, I'm in verse 3, 4, 6, 7.
Yeah, then he was cut off from the wisdom of the Lord.
By oppression and judgment, he was taken away. For his generation, he considered that he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. And they made his grave with the wicked, and the rich man in his dead. Although he had done no violence, there was no deceit
of any whatever they returned.
It was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him.
Okay. Let's see what we can come up with. So I guess we should go in numerical order, right? Group one, exaltation of Jehovah as king. Kind of kingship language or behaviors did you find in this chapter?
Righteousness was mentioned a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
In the letter. I didn't know, and you were. I was hopefully trying to find judgment in this particular those attributes, but that the kings. The existing kings talks about them shutting their mouths and causing him.
Yeah,
that would suggest that he's higher.
Yes.
Than those.
And in fact, in verse 13, the servant is exalted in a kingly way. He's high and lifted up and greatly exalted, right? And then there's all these other kings that are, by virtue of not having an answer for what he's done, they are subjecting themselves to him. And the other one is kingship behavior that I found was. In verse 12, where God is dividing up the spoil, right? He allots the servant a portion with the great, and he maybe that he is the servant, maybe it's God, and I'm going to argue it doesn't really matter for this exercise. That's kingly behavior, dividing up the spoil after a battle.
Oh, that's so. That's,
yeah. So,
what's ironic is he gets the spoil after he's dead.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Only
Other
part I said was. He was despised and we did not esteem him.
Yeah.
He was not given the
right.
honor that and glory.
And if you knew that the servant was a king, then that dishonor would be even more striking, right? And that's one of the sort of terrible ironies about the way the Jews treated Jesus, right, is that he was a king. All right, good. Group two, holiness as a defining characteristic of Jehovah. Which one's group two? I forget. That, you
that
guys
slide here.
Okay.
Well, verse 6 talks about the iniquity of us all being laid upon him, so God's holiness could not abide iniquity. It had to be dealt with.
Yep. Yeah.
And verse 10 talks about gave himself as a guilt offering because there had to be an offering because of sin.
Right.
And then 11 talks about he sees it, or sees the light as it's been said this morning, and he's satisfied.
Good.
That holiness has to be dealt with in some way.
That's right. And in fact, it shows up earlier than that, and I'll explain why in just a minute. It shows up earlier in 52:15, he will sprinkle many nations. That's the sprinkling of purification that was part of the old law. So it shows up there as well as a preview of what Grady has just described towards the end of 53. Good. All right, group three, universality of Jehovah's kingdom. Which is group three? Is that you guys?
We're going to use a lot of the same verses.
Yeah, well, there are only like 15 verses to choose.
But as you go through, you start to see a little bit of everything.
That's right.
I think the sprinkling of many nations is to be used. It's for everyone. The iniquity of us all, so it's all of our sins.
I will argue that all there is not referring to all of mankind explicitly at first, but I think eventually it does. Now that I've confused you, go ahead.
We got there eventually.
Yeah.
What else did we have?
Verse 10. The seed and the Lord's pleasure will be accomplished.
Okay, so you're saying that applies universally.
Yes.
Right.
Well,
you're
and
jumping ahead into a New Testament.
Yeah,
but yes,
yeah.
That's right. That's right. Good.
So we have to understand it fully.
What?
Nothing. I was just kidding.
And then I would.
Why would you not understand?
The assignment was unfairly cut off at verse 12, and you should and also include Cathedral 1 through 3, which has a lot of the universality stuff.
That's right.
You said I couldn't, so I just didn't.
That's right. But you're right. That is where the universality of it, and that's why I said if you jump ahead a little bit, you see it even clearer, because the universality is the result of the servant's work in many ways. So that's, it maybe was a little bit unfair, but I had to give the same rules to everybody. Those verses would only have benefited your group. So, number 5, people's inability to hear the word of Jehovah. No, skip 4, sinfulness of Jehovah's chosen people.
I believe that's ours. I think that was probably the easiest one out of all of them, because almost all the verses hit on how we have people have rejected or oppressed this Messiah.
Yeah.
I think it's also summed up in verse 12 where it says that he bore the sins of many, so you know that the people have sinned because it says they have sinned.
It undergirds the reason that this chapter, it is the reason that this chapter exists. It undergirds every action in the chapter. Exactly right. Yeah. So that was the easy one. The answer is yes. But good. I'm glad you picked verse 12 as the kind of representation of that, because that's the one that I had noted as well. So you're right, because your answer matches mine. You win. Okay, now, number 5. People's inability to hear the word.
We kind of honed in on verse 15. So the inability to hear the word. For what they have been told, them they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand.
Okay, good. So those verses are a little bit odd, and I'm glad you pointed them out, because that's part of the... I think we have to wrestle with what verse 15 means in order to understand what 53:1 means. But in some ways, I would maybe also add 53:1 to your list, right? Who has believed our message? Again, not totally sure what that means, at least in the drama that I'm creating for this class. Right now, I'm not sure what it means. I'll be sure in about 3 minutes. But I think we have to figure that one out in the same context. So good. I think those two verses go together around this point about people's inability to hear the word. And then our all-star group, what did you find for the people's exile and return? And I went back there and gave him a hint, which is that in Isaiah, applied to both Isaiah himself and the servant, the exile and return are applied and discussed in very personal terms, not just in national terms. I gave them that as a clue.
So he was despised and rejected, and people have seen them smitten by God and afflicted. That all applies, in a sense, to the nation.
Right.
Because they were afflicted by God. In verse 8, he was cut off from the land of the living.
The land.
Right. And then even in verse... what was the other one?
11. At least that's what I don't know if that's what you were thinking. But I'm just going there to see the labor of his soul and be satisfied.
Yeah.
And even in the Bible knowledge of his righteous servant, many... shall be justified, many. And that means if they're justified now, they formerly they were not justified.
Right.
Exile.
And there's this return from captivity language in 10 through 12, right?
Yeah, and then also in verse 12, the spoil.
Yeah.
When Cyrus gave the decree, he gave them the materials to build the temple.
Yep. And the idea of seeing his offspring, prolonging his days, this is all, you know, you're going to go back and you'll see your grandchildren in the land.
How did we do?
You got it. The only other one that I would add is 52:14. Just as many were astonished at you, my people. There's some argument about what that verse means, but if you read it with the my people, which is interpolated by the translators, as accurate, then he's basically saying, just like the captivity is going to be terrible, so is the way that he will be mistreated. So there's that, possibly that parallel, if you read that as referring to Israel and not as directly addressed to the servant.
Which was that?
Well, you stopped us before we got there. Mary was about to say that.
I believe.
That's
a quarter
milliliter.
52:14. Just as many were astonished at you, and then some translations don't include anything else after that, but many interpolate my people because it seems to make sense, but there's an argument to be made that that line is addressed directly to the servant. And I don't find the evidence on either side fully convincing, so I'm not going to take a position on it. But if it is referring to the people, that is a direct reference to the captivity as an image of what the Messiah would suffer, the servant would suffer, in his being rejected and then being resurrected, returned. All right. So let's get into the text now. We talked about 52:13-15 last time, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But notice that in this section, God is speaking, and it forms a bookend with the end of chapter 53, where God speaks again. And I think that is intentional. You've got a bookend on this description, where God speaks. And it serves as an introductory summary of chapter 53. This language of behold is very common in Isaiah. He also uses phrases like awake, awake, or hear this. And they indicate that an important message is beginning. You can look at 7:13 and 14 and see actually two of those kind of listen to this phrases in the prophecy about the virgin birth. But it indicates that a kind of a new and important section is beginning. And it emphasizes the effect of the servant's work on the nations, verse 15. We've already talked about that. And it tells us in summary form that the servant will be exalted after he suffers to purify. That's the reference to sprinkling. And in doing so, he's going to astound the rulers. They won't have an answer for this. They won't know how to respond to it. In 49:7, there's similar language. The kings will arise, see and arise, princes will also bow down because of the Lord who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel who has chosen you. There, in the context of a return from captivity, we have a similar behavior on the part of the nations around them. Here, it seems to be applied directly to the work of the servant. The other thing that I would, we'll get into that in, I'm going to say that now. So in verse 15, we've already talked about how there's this language at the end of what had not been told them they will see, and what they had not heard they will understand. And I think the best way to understand what those lines mean is to look at 53:1, which is also a little bit confusing, because why does the person who is speaking in 53:1 saying, nobody believes me when I tell them this, later say, and I rejected the servant? It's the same person. It's the same pronoun. It's the first person plural. But it's not the royal we. It's not God speaking, because God speaks, and God is later in the chapter and before this, and God is referenced as an actor in this drama. The speakers are the recipients of the actions of the servant. Verse 4, our grief he himself bore, our sorrows he carried. Right? So they are the recipients of it who rejected him, and yet in verse 1 they say, but nobody's listening to us. So what does that mean? How does that connect to 52:15? And I think maybe the answer is that they are complaining not just that no one is listening to them, but that the people who should have been listening were not. The people who already had a background in God's great works, the people of Israel, wouldn't listen, but the nations who had not been told these things and had not heard them will see them and will understand, right? And that's 52:15. So these nations, when the work of the servant is declared to them, they fall in line with it. They obey. They shut their mouths. They don't have an answer for it. But God's people, who had seen God's work all through history, who had these promises revealed to them, they don't believe it. And so the speaker of chapter 53 begins with, nobody believes us, and they should have. Even the Gentiles will believe this, and the Jews won't. It's a very similar thought to the kinds of laments that Paul expresses in Romans about the Jews not believing. 53:1-10 then is Israel, I think, the nation of Israel, recounting the servant's suffering and redemption. Now, that in itself is interesting. We need to talk about it. But in this text, Israel speaks in the past tense about their initial rejection and later acceptance of the servant, right? The whole chapter is written as describing something that has already been accomplished. But Israel speaking for God instead of like arguing with him or just disobeying him is a little bit unusual in the prophets. So I think we should examine that. Why do you think Israel speaks to describe the servant's life of mistreatment in chapter 53? Why is Israel the one who is speaking? And then what in the context of the New Testament, how does this help us understand the preaching of Christ and the early church, especially to the Jews? Is that a really confusing question? I'm struggling with how to ask that.
Well, I think it may be that instead of Israel as a whole, it may be referring to the prophets of Israel.
So that is one view of this chapter.
So who have constantly gone out and said, this is God's will, you need to follow this, you need to do this.
Yes.
And it hasn't been believed, even by their
right.
brethren. So that's one way to look at it.
Yes.
I'm not sure if that's the only way to look at it.
Right, so I would, in counterpoint, I would say those seem to be the same speakers who are speaking in verse 3, we did not esteem in verse 4, we ourselves esteemed him stricken.
Yeah.
The prophets were not the ones who were rejecting God. It was the rest of the nation, right? But
if you look at Daniel, though, he said
he does
accept yes,
God.
That's
right. Right.
That's possible.
That's right.
That's
good. Yes.
Mason, this is an observation I had. It's like he starts out, he's the prophet, and he's speaking, and then he switches voice. He's speaking on behalf of the Jewish nation and saying, we have done this, and that's echoed in the apostles the day of, in Acts 2,
right.
When they're talking about, this is what you've done as a nation, this is what you've done to the servant. So I feel like he's kind of speaking it for them.
Right. Could be. Well, we're all sort of like kind of getting towards slowly is that maybe we need to redefine Israel. Maybe that would make it easier to understand this, right? Can you think of Israel where Israel is used in a different way to describe a different group of people than the physical descendants of Abraham?
Christians.
Yeah, the spiritual descendants of Abraham.
Yeah.
I think this is a future Israel. It's a new Israel. It is a recreated Israel that is looking backwards and admitting their own guilt in the suffering of the servant, but also confessing the blessings that the servant has brought to them, and also, at the same time, lamenting the fact that not everyone believes. I think this is a speech of a converted Israel explaining why they changed their mind and also lamenting that rejection. And part of what makes that rejection so poignant is, as 52:15 I think is telling us, the Gentiles often accepted it with no prior knowledge of God and his plans and power. But the Jews who had seen the arm of the Lord revealed time after time rejected this ultimate revelation of God's power and love for his people. So the chapter then functions both as a prophecy of the servant's life, mission, and glory, but also as a witness against Israel for rejecting him. And I think significantly for the first century Jews, it's in the past tense. It describes the events as things that have already happened, showing how God had always been working to change Israel's mind about the servant, plural, but the servant in particular that they have rejected. I think it's all intentional, and I think based on that there is not a shift in voice speaker in the chapter. I think it is all this recreated Israel speaking from verse 1 all the way to verse 11. But I'm willing to hear arguments to the opposite, and I won't argue very long because it's a little bit above my head. What we have then in verses 1 through 10 is an expansion of the ideas that are summarized back in chapter 52. This unprepossessing physical appearance both in his life and during his suffering, and the servant who suffers in order to redeem and purify in verses 8 and 10. And this is really important, chapter 53 has a key detail that we have not seen before in Isaiah, and that is that the servant is going to die. Even when you begin to read this chapter, it's not clear that the servant is going to die. He talks about, we esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted, pierced and crushed and chastened, scourged. But you can survive all of those things. But when you get down to verses 7 through 9, a lamb that is led to the slaughter, he was cut off out of the land of the living, his grave was assigned with the rich, and I think we need to see that. We need to feel the surprise, the shock, that the servant has to die. And Grady asked why? I don't know. But he did. And I think we need to see 53 not just as assuming the servant will die, but as telling us for the first time that the servant is going to die. And think about the shock that that must have caused for someone reading this to go, nope, but he dies. And yet God blesses him. How does that work? How is that going to be resolved? It recolors kind of previous and future language about this crushing and scourging and chastening. And that's why we are not surprised to find that the servant dies when we get to the end of the chapters, because we read those other descriptions as kind of leading to death. You don't have to read them that way. I think we should try to read it as Israel would have, to be surprised and shocked and amazed and humbled by the fact that the servant dies to redeem his people. I did want to say about this, that the servant, it says he's with the rich at his death. That is highlighted in all four Gospels, and I think it serves as an instant vindication of Christ as innocent, because he's unworthy of a criminal's burial, and therefore unworthy of a criminal's death. But it's also a proof case of the theme of this chapter, that those who rejected the servant at first have come to accept him. And that's fulfilled when verse 9 is fulfilled, when Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, who had initially rejected Christ and were doubtful about him, are the ones, the rich men, who bury him after he's died. So it fulfills it, but it also proves that the chapter, that the change of heart that the chapter also encapsulates can actually be fulfilled in people's lives. In 53:11 through 12, God speaks again. And he blesses the servant's work. He speaks to justify the servant's righteousness in suffering, because the suffering justified many, because he bore their iniquities, and the servant is going to be rewarded for this suffering. And then this is the most important point, and I apologize for having to rush through this, but In Isaiah 53, we have the introduction of a concept that for us is central to Christ's work, but up until Isaiah 53 had never been discussed in messianic prophetic terms, and that is the idea of substitutionary atonement. We just sort of take that for granted, right? There are only three places in the Old Testament that specifically talk about substitutionary atonement, and they are Exodus 12, the Passover, the blood on the doorposts, the Day of Atonement, the scapegoat that bears the sins of the people, in Leviticus 16, and here in Isaiah 53. I guess I should point out where it says that. He bore the sins of many and interceded for the transgressors. Verse 12 at the end of the verse. It is the only place where the work of the servant, of the Messiah, is described in terms of substitutionary atonement. And I think it's interesting that even though they're not referenced in a sacrificial context, the image of sheep is used to describe both the people in verse 6 and the servant himself in verse 7, right? I think we're intended to be kind of driven towards this vision of the servant as an atonement in the model of the Passover lamb and the scapegoat in Exodus and Leviticus. But the language of sacrifice is used in verse 10. The servant offers himself as a guilt offering, a sacrifice made as a payment for transgressions. And so I think it's significant that in verse 12 God explicitly describes the servant's death as substitutionary atonement. He bore the sin of many and he interceded for the transgressor. That's Isaiah's contribution to messianic prophecy probably cannot be overestimated, but if you don't remember anything else from Isaiah, remember 53:12. substitutionary atonement. That is the most important thing you will see in the entire book of Isaiah, probably in the entire Old Testament, that the suffering servant would atone for the people by dying for them. It's a radical idea. It's one that the Jews kind of struggle to understand in a Messianic context, but it is what Christ did, and that's why 53 is so powerful and so important. Okay, thank you for your attention. We've got a review. Last time there were lessons 13 on the way out.
And we'll spend probably the last 10 or 15 minutes of class based on your input. So it'll be a quiet 15 minutes if you don't do your lesson.